For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Zan Brooks, filling in for Jason Solomons, who's at home with his newborn babe. This week, it's the week of the Ryans. First up, we hear from Ryan Gosling on his heart-wrenching performance in Blue Valentine alongside Michelle Williams. And after that, Jason meets director Ryan Fleck to discuss his teen comedy, It's Kind of a Funny Story. Catherine Shourd, films editor at guardian.co.uk, joins me later to review some of the week's other releases, including Hilary Swank fighting for justice in Conviction, and Seth Rogen fighting pretty much everyone in The Green Hornet. All that and a chance to win a VIP ticket to a special screening of David Byrne's Ride, Rise, Roar. There's talking heads and so much more. It's Film Weekly. The actor Ryan Gosling has the looks, talent and charm needed to be a Hollywood A-lister, but he seems determined to let the quality of his work get in the way of his career. Starting out with his breakthrough role as a Jewish neo-Nazi in The Believer, he's drawn to awkward characters in tricky films. Now, Gosling was Oscar-nominated in 2007 for his superb performance as a high school teacher with a drug problem in Half Nelson, and it looks like he may get another chance this week with Blue Valentine. A labour of love for writer-director Derek Chanfrance, Blue Valentine took nearly 12 years to realise. Its lead actors developed their characters over several years, forbidden to meet or actually discuss the parts. The film is a fractured portrait of the fractured marriage of Dean, played by Gosling, and Cindy, played by Michelle Williams. It's a drama about profound love and wrenching disappointment. And Jason Solomons caught up with Ryan Gosling to discuss his role. But first, let's hear Gosling and Williams in action in Blue Valentine.
Baby. What? I got your present.
That's it. Hold on. Boom.
Baby.
I got make it. I didn't make it, but I got us a song. You know, like our song that would just be for you and me. Because everybody's got songs, but they're lame, and they all share them. You know, it's disgusting. Not us. We have our own song.
We have our own. What is it?
Do you want to listen to it?
Ryan Gosling, welcome to Film Week.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on Blue Valentine. Fantastic performance. It's kind of isn't it? Because as soon as he comes on screen, your character, you kind of think, don't know about this guy. And then by the end, you're like, I don't know about this guy. Is it difficult to play a person who's both lovable and yet has this kind of well of undesirability about him too?
Well, I feel like most people are like that, so I get, especially the people that I, when I was growing up, forming my impressions about people, those were the people I was around, you know, and I felt like they weren't really reflected in films that often, at least the movies I was watching. You know, I feel like the actors are like carved out of marble and made in the image of gods, you know, and I like movies that are made in the image of man.
Yeah, I mean, your character in Half Nelson was similar as well.
Yeah, these sort of I believe that, you know, flaws are what make us special and unique, you know, and they're hard to accept in yourself, but they're also hard to accept because we're always trying to strive to this level of perfection that movies create, you know.
When you talk about those, I mean, it's interesting because I find you a terrific actor to watch, and there's always this, you're always winning kind of breakthrough actor awards and the best actor of his generation, whatever generation that may be. I think it's something to do with you and Casey Affleck. There's the two of you in that generation, and then I don't know who else is in there. But it's a good generation to be part of. But you refer to those kind of granite-hewn kind of marble gods of the big screen. Are you talking about the kind of old-school actors, the Brandos, the McQueens, the Newmans, or are you talking about a kind of another era of actors?
I just mean the idea that movies are trying to kind of create this this version of reality, which isn't very real, you know, and that people always learn something from their mistakes, and that there's a resolution at the end of, you know, like, that time stops when the movie ends, you know, that the character is like, complete or something,
yeah.
You know, that the characters don't live on after the movie ends, or, you know, that they're, the things that they want out of life are very different than how they behave, you know, that the, you know, that we're just there's you know we're products of you know our parents, the way that we grow mm-hmm. up, you know, how much of it is who we are and how much of it is this kind of sins of the father,
some kind of real psychology that you're putting in there. It's interesting. Why I'm interested in it is because of the kind of heroism that one used to seek on the big screen from those kind of those marble gods of the big screen who acted like heroes. I'm even going back to Bogart and Jimmy Stewart, mm-hmm. Those kind of guys. And then the modern actor, there's a lot of kind of, I don't know, there's a lot of kind of geeks around, nerds around. That's kind of very kind of current in American indie film. In fact, you kind of played one of yourself in Lars and the Real Girl. Yeah. And now you're, who is obviously very flawed, but now with Half Nelson, and this Blue Valentine, you seem to have a kind of more of a handle on the kind of on what the male, to me at least, the kind of modern male crisis is, and I think you reflect that beautifully.
Oh, thanks.
If that was the idea.
Yeah,
it is tough. I mean, certainly Blue Valentine, it's tough to be a modern man and do everything that is necessary to be done to keep the family going, to keep love alive, to keep the daughter alive, to be charming, to be funny, to be sexy.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm happy to find filmmakers that want to explore those characters, because I certainly do, and you know, those are the kind of movies that, you know, I like to go and see too, you know, and feel like those. I don't like a lot of movies because I don't feel like they don't like me. Mm-hmm. You know? I see movies that, you know, like I don't know, like Fat City or something, you know, Stacey Keach mm-hmm. and Jeff Bridges, and I feel like, you know, like that movie was, you know. That movie cares about me or something.
So John Huston, you would have worked with him.
I wish.
But these things are tough, and that's why I asked you when you were growing up and you wanted to be an actor. I don't know when that came into your head, that moment, whose style you were kind of going for, because acting is a kind of, you know, you see someone and you kind of go, that's the guy, I want to do it like him.
Right.
Was it, were there anyone any of those for you?
Well, I think. I don't know. I saw Cuba Gooding Jr. in Boys in the Hood, you know? Mm-hmm. And that guy thought, like, that maybe I wanted to act. The thing that made me want to make movies, but before I saw that, I saw Blue Velvet. I was 14, and Blue Velvet kind of changed my life, mm-hmm. made me want to make movies. I didn't understand.
In general, you didn't want to be the Dennis Hopper character, the Kyle?
No, it wasn't an acting thing, though. Mm-hmm. It was just that I was more interested in David Lynch. I was mm-hmm. more interested in who is this person that believes in their ideas this much, you know, mm-hmm. that I'd never seen anything like it. It was such a singular vision. It was just this one man's reality, and he believed in it enough to get these actors to say these things and to create this world. And it was the kind of experience you could only have through watching that film. And I just wanted to be somebody like that. I don't know if it was just to make movies, but I wanted to be somebody that believed in his ideas mm-hmm. that much. And, you know, I moved to Los Angeles when I was 16 because I just wanted to kind of meet David Lynch, you know, right. and I saw Lost Highway when I moved there, and it just kind of furthered it for me, you know.
You met him yet?
I did, yeah. I finally met him last year.
Good. Did you tell him all this?
I did.
Good. Yeah. Did he move, sidle away and go, thanks?
He said, Ryan, your head is a jar, and it's filled with mud. And every time you shake the jar, you get rid of a little bit of mud.
Well, you shook it pretty vigorously in Blue Valentine, because there's a lot coming off that screen that is, as I say, charming, sexy, vulnerable, hateful in some cases as well, if I may say, not to you, but towards your character.
You may.
To do such a film like this, so intimate, so strong, your performance has to be, obviously with Michelle Williams, you have to be kind of completely kind of in tune. How did you work with her? Were you old friends with her? How did you kind of work it out together?
We didn't know each other at all. All I knew is that she'd been on board for 6 years, and she knew that I'd been on for four, and that we were working on our characters for all that time.
So does she hold the upper hand then?
She does. She's got seniority.
Yeah.
But so when you go into a film knowing, you know, that's like, I knew who she was without really knowing her, you know, she'd proven herself to me. She stuck it out that long. I had so much respect for her and the director, obviously 12 years trying to make this movie. So we all had each other's trust, which is what we needed, and so we could hit the ground running, you know. And we were meant not to know each other, because Derek kept us away from each other all those years because he wanted us to meet on camera, right, in character.
Tell me about singing You Always Hurt the One You Love. Your idea? Your voice, your dream to play the ukulele and sing that? Is that like coming, going out, Hello Wembley? Is that a big moment for you?
Yeah, sadly, yeah. Yeah, when you put it like that, yeah.
You can tap dance?
Can you?
No.
Here, I'll play a song and you dance. Okay. I can't really sing. I have to sing goofy in order to sing. Like, I have to sing stupid. Okay?
Okay.
The director said he wanted us to develop talents that were specific to our characters and not us, so he said that I could do whatever I wanted, but I needed to develop some talents. So I learned how to play the ukulele, kind of, and I worked on sort of a version of that song, and I learned some other things too that maybe didn't make the movie. Michelle learned how to tap dance and say all the presidents, learned how to palm read.
All for that scene.
Well, all this, just to have in our pocket, so he could say to us, the way that it all came about was he said, I'm going to shoot from sundown to sunup, and I'm going to shoot whatever you do. So, just get ready. So we knew this night was coming. We didn't know what was going to happen. And, like 5 hours into the night, he says to us that maybe you want to show each other your talents, So now was an opportunity for us. It's like show and tell, So yeah. I asked Michelle, you got any talents? And suddenly she started tap dancing. And then the whole scene unfolded. And I think, what's interesting is that a lot of times in the movie, when something's happening for the first time to us, or what's happening for the first time for the audience is also happening the first time for us.
Yeah. Well, it is beautiful because normally someone says to me, there's an American kind of romance film in which the guy sings "You Always Hurt the One You Love" falsetto on ukulele and she tap dances. I think, oh my god, that sounds awful. So kudos to both of you that it's actually something extremely beautiful.
Thanks very much.
It's one of the hardest things to do, not just the singing, but the whole getting that ineffable moment of love kind of across on film.
Yeah, the director is a very special guy, and he's kind of like one of those people. You ever see Planet Earth?
Yeah.
Like those guys sitting in a tree for 6 months just waiting for a bird to come out and do some little mating ritual. It hardly seems worth it, but when you see the show, you think it's totally worth it. And it's like the most special thing you've ever seen, the way this like little bird like makes a nest or something or woos his lady. And Derek's like that. I mean, he waited 12 years to watch me and Michelle Williams create these characters and then fall in love.
Yeah. Here in the undergrowth, I see a Gosling and a Williams. Don't move. They're very precious creatures. There you are, very, very beautiful creatures. And also loving Penny in the Quarters right now. That's that is a perfect My song that you need to have someone. That you found that. I don't know who found that. You dug that one out.
That was there's a label called the Numero Group, and they basically archive all this this rare music. That's that bit. They called them Penny in the Quarter because they don't know their name. It was just a name like that they gave them. Yeah. But they found that song in a recording booth, and I think it was done in one take. So it was very much the spirit of our film. Like, we did a lot of it in one take, and so it felt appropriate.
One Take Wonder, Ryan Gosling. Brilliant to have you on Film Weekly. Congratulations on Blue Valentine. I hope that we see a lot more of you throughout the awards season. The Golden Globes nominations are going to come through in a minute, so please guard you're on there. But maybe you're too saucy. I don't know. Or you sing too high. I don't know. But
I sing too high.
You do. Yeah. Lovely to have you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
You and me, baby.
And Blue Valentine goes on general release here in the UK from Friday the 14th. Now, joining me to review some of the week's other releases is The Guardian film editor and writer Catherine Shord. Welcome back to the pod, Catherine.
Hello.
So, Blue Valentine, it's a portrait of a marriage, but it's fairly far from a rom-com, isn't it?
Somebody, I think Ryan Gilby, tweeted that it says something about a film when the most light-hearted moment is when somebody tells a joke about child abuse. And that's really true of this film. It is quite, it's really, for all its merits, it's quite hard to recommend because it is so unremittingly depressing. I came away with a very, very bad headache, which I didn't have before.
So talk me through it. It's basically a kind of a long dying scrabbling fall, the collapse of a marriage.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's, you know, if you think of a horrible breakup and you imagine that played out for 2 hours, it's a couple and you see them at first and they're married. They've got a sort of 3-year-old daughter and their marriage is falling apart.
How does it compare with, I mean, there's a sort of weird little tradition of these kind of Portrait of a Failing Marriage films. There's obviously there's Bergman's Portrait of a Marriage, but there's Revolutionary Road, and then there's Five Times Two, the Francois Ozon film from a while ago. Does this kind of stand well with all of those?
Basically, it didn't. I mean, I think Revolutionary Road, I didn't massively like it, but it had an intensity to it. So I think the trap you often fall into with these films is that they become vehicles for the actors to strut their miserable stuff. And indeed, Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams have both been nominated for acting Golden Globes and probably for Oscars. And it does feel a little bit like a kind of a bit of an improv workshop at times, and
but there's a place. I mean, you know, this is the one thing you could say in this film's favour is it's a sort of American drama that doesn't really get made anymore. Where you've obviously got loads of rehearsal time. It's obviously workshopped. Isn't that a good thing?
It is. I think one needs to be a bit cynical about I've heard and read the story so many times about how they spent a month, living as a couple and budgeting and having birthdays and building up memories between shooting the first part of the film and the second part of the film. And, you know, that's great. That's obviously great. But frankly, you kind of hope they would. It's a movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to pay a tenner to go and see it. I kind of want them to put a bit of time and thought into it, you know. And similarly with the ratings row about it, it got a rating that they thought in America would prevent it from getting Oscar nominations and prevent it from getting a wide audience. And so
this is because of one particular sex scene in there.
Yeah. And I mean, this controversy, people think, oh, it's an edgy film and it's exciting, and they defied the Academy, and the Academy actually reversed the decision without them having to make any kind of cut. And also you sort of think, well, you know, it's going to have a bit of edgy sex in it. You're going to be disappointed if you go looking for porn.
Okay, well then if we're disappointed, or Catherine's disappointed, we can go looking for porn elsewhere. And the next film on the hunt is Conviction, which is a true life drama about a man who was wrongly jailed for murdering a little old lady back in 1983, in the era before DNA, I guess. It stars Sam Rockwell as Kenny, who's the town tearaway, who gets banged up for rights, and Hilary Swank as his sister Betty Ann, who embarks on a hasty course of legal training in order to prove her brother's innocence.
So this is what I'm going to do, Ian. Don't laugh, all right? I'm going to stop by trying to get a BA. After I finally take the stupid GED test, and after that, if I even get that far, and there's no guarantee I'll even get in, I'll apply to law school. But I mean, it's gonna take a long time, Kenny, a really long time. And I mean, I might be 80 years old before I finally become a lawyer. And even then, I
do you know, when I hear that a film is based on a true story, my heart automatically sinks.
Yeah, and actually, I share that feeling. But then when you see this film, it actually seems more boring than real life could ever be.
Yeah.
More predictable, more like it's scripted by a Hollywood factory than true life. You know, it's really a really clockwork plot, this, and with exactly the same twists and turns. And in fact, the real life story is more interesting. And for instance, the guy Kenny in real life died 6 months after he came out of prison in a freak accident, which would have made it quite a sort of spunky coder.
Yeah.
But they didn't, you know, they didn't do that. They turned it into a kind of Hallmark made for TV movie, which, you know, quite an interesting story, really. It's a shame.
I mean, the key problem as well with it is that there should be some ambiguity about whether he did it or not. And as soon as you know it's based on a true story and she proves him innocent, then you're basically just kind of ticking off the various
They do toy with it a little bit, and there's some sort of vague element, but then it swiftly becomes clear, I think, in the same scene that no, he is totally innocent, and she's unambiguously great, and God, you know. And I mean, there's some colourful cameos in here. Juliet Lewis, who plays a kind of white trash slut, who testifies to his guilt, but completely being paid off by the cops. She's fantastic. I mean, it's worth it a little bit for these fantastic cameos.
You've got Melissa Leo in there as well, who of course was in Frozen River.
Yeah, and she's the sort of bent cop who pays Juliet Lewis to tell all these lies. But I wasn't ever quite sure why. What the hell she's got against Sam Rockwell. You know, he's a bit cheeky.
But he's the sort of bad egg, isn't he? He's caused them trouble all his life.
Yeah, a little bit. But I mean, he's also, you know, he's also your cheeky chappy. He's not so bad. I mean, he's just like, you're all right, really.
They don't like the cheeky chappies in small town America, though.
I think they do. You know, when he there's a scene where they go to a bar and he gets in a fight, punches some guy out, and then strips, and everyone's whooping and cheering and hollering and loving him. I mean, that kind of behaviour, frankly, I'd be a bit shocked, but apparently that goes down very well.
You get that at The Guardian every Friday night. But I mean, they're good actors. Sam Rockwell is one of the kind of more underrated actors in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Hilary Swank has won, you know, two Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, remember her last film was Amelia.
I didn't really like that one much.
No, she's not having a great run at the moment. I mean, this film is actually in that way quite similar to Blue Valentine because it's two good actors, very good actors, quite showboating, quite also taking executive producer roles to give them the opportunity to showboat and also play kind of, you know, sort of the earth good types who are in difficult positions and getting screwed around, you know, by the wealthy, powers that be. You know, they're quite shameless performances, all of these. And I think Hilary Swank particularly, you know, people are saying this is her Erin Brockovich. It totally isn't. It's completely plastic, really. It's a real pity.
It's interesting you're mentioning about the executive producer credit because I think all three of the films that we're discussing today have that. Blue Valentine did, Conviction does, and Green Hornet does as well because Seth Rogen co-wrote and executive produced it. It's almost like it's becoming the badge of slight suspectness, isn't it?
I do. I mean, that's like me also saying, well, I'll make the sandwiches, you know. And I mean, it's not quite like that. But it's
a bit more lofty than that, though, isn't it? I don't think any of these people made the sandwich.
But yeah, there's something a bit distasteful about it, and it's a bit poacher and gamekeeper, and also rabbit, you know,
and rabbit as well. it's a big pie. The Green Hornet, which are you going to go and see this? Can I spoil this for you?
I'm not going to go and see it actually.
Okay,
sorry.
The Green Hornet stars Seth Rogen as the wastrel bachelor son of a newspaper magnate. And Jay Chou as his sidekick, Kato, and together they start out fighting crime by the most unorthodox means at their disposal.
Think about this, Kato. What is the one insanely stupid thing every superhero has in common?
Tights?
No.
Cape?
No, Kato. It's that everyone knows that they're the good guy, the hero. You know, all the bad guy has to do is start capping some innocent people, and he's got the good guy by the nuts. He's got to do whatever he says. It's in every movie. It's in every comic book. It's in everything. It's so stupid. But if the bad guy thought the good guy was also a bad guy, he wouldn't be able to do that. That's what we'll do differently.
Now, Catherine, The Green Hornet is another one of those kind of deconstructed superhero movies, like Megamind, like Despicable Me, and like those films, it treads a fine line between whether it's a sort of spoof of all the conventions of Spider-Man and Hulk and Superman and all that, or whether it's a salute to them. And I guess these films have become so much part of our landscape that we're so familiar with them that you can play with the form a little bit. But within that, you've got to know what you're doing. And if there's a problem with The Green Hornet, I was never quite sure it knows exactly what it's doing.
Can imagine.
And it's Michel Gondry, who I really like, who's directing it, and he was brought on late. And it just has that feel of a film that's been kind of pulled in every direction, and nobody knows quite what it is. Within that, there's some nice scenes and some nice sort of fun moments in there. But, you know, we've been going around London for the last couple of weeks, and it seems to be on the side of every bus. There's Christoph Waltz as the kind of kingpin villain, Chudnovsky. And I keep seeing his face everywhere. And so, obviously, the studio has very high hopes for this being a blockbuster. And yet, I'm not sure it's going to be.
I'm not convinced at all. I mean, the last Michel Gondry film I think I saw was Science of Sleep, which I thought I might rip my own eyes out. Is it in any way similar? That was the Gael Garcia.
I didn't mind that so much. Really? You see, I almost wish it was a bit more like that. I think that they think that they want this sort of quirky, do-it-yourself French oddball to kind of come along and give a fresh spin on this sort of old rote material. And yet they his wings have been clipped a little bit. So he's still a kind of director for hire. So you don't get any of the things that exasperated you so much, but I think Gondry fans really want. Mm. You get a little kind of snippets here and there, but it definitely feels like somebody who's been told to do a proper job and don't sort of mess with the formula.
And will Seth Rogen fans like it?
I don't know. I've really got no idea. It doesn't have enough jokes in it. Mm. I'm sure there are probably more jokes at one rough cut of the film. Mm. But then one executive said, you know, we need it to be more of a proper superhero movie with more action. And then another one was saying, well, mate, what about the jokes? And you almost think that it's one of those films where the behind the scenes on it was probably way more interesting in terms of drama and spats and fireworks than actually what you see on the screen. That's The Green Hornet, which is also out on release from Friday the 14th. And Catherine Shord, thank you so much for joining me to review this week's films.
An enormous pleasure. And the side jar of 2 cent coins, they are no good no more. She lay aside.
You know, I've been thinking about it a lot recently, and I've realized that if you're not busy being born, you're busy dying. And I for one think that we could both benefit from being born again. Not being born again, but you know what I mean?
Gee, thanks for the wisdom, Bob.
What, he told you that too?
Who?
Bobby.
Yeah, me and about a billion other people. Bob Dylan? That's the song you just quoted.
What? No?
Yes.
Oh.
Keir Gilchrist as Craig there, blissfully ignorant of the great Bob Dylan, alongside Emma Roberts as Noelle, in a scene from It's Kind of a Funny Story. Now, this tells the tale of Craig, a troubled teenager who admits himself into an adult psychiatric ward, and there runs across the full gamut of idiosyncratic patients, not least the aforementioned Bobby, played by that bearded wonder, Zach Galifianakis. The film is the third feature from a duo who are actually responsible for giving Gosling his break on Half Nelson, Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden. To find out more, Jason Solomons caught up with director Ryan Fleck.
Ryan Fleck, welcome back to Film Weekly. I say welcome back. We've had you on for Half Nelson, we've had you on for Sugar, and it's lovely to see you again for It's Kind of a Funny Story, so welcome back.
Yes, thank you for having me.
It came from a novel, which is not a book that I was aware of until, in fact, the final credits, where it said based on the book by. That's how you came across it, which I presume is the first one of your first kind of bits that isn't originally written between yourself and your partner, Anna Boden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. After we'd made Half Nelson and premiered it at Sundance, this was in early 2006, we went to Los Angeles and met with a bunch of studios and producers, and one of them gave us this book, which is a young adult novel called It's Kind of a Funny Story, written by Ned Vizzini, and it's very loosely based on an experience that he had in a hospital. And the tone of the book was really nice because it was funny, but it also balanced the humor with really nice, touching, dramatic moments and some really earnest, fun characters and not much cynicism. The lack of cynicism was really interesting, especially from a teen protagonist, because it feels like so many teenagers are sarcastic and overly witty and sort of...
Well, in cinema they are. Whether they are in real life, I don't know.
Because they're coming through an adult perspective that I think that filter, the adult filter, somehow gets in the way of the purity of the teen experience. And so we really just wanted to capture that from their own eyes.
Because as you say, this is a teenage film, but with a difference. It has a kind of an honesty, and it borrows many techniques as well from, you know, animation to I don't know, I suppose One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest kind of 70s style filmmaking, plus a bit of the indie filmmaking of the 80s that I was talking about, and plus your own styles.
Yeah, it's sort of all over the map. What's nice about the movie from my perspective as a filmmaker is that it allows us to go into subjective places that we didn't explore too much in the first movies. The first movies were very much 100% grounded in the reality before your eyes. This one, we go into the character's head, and we really go into his past, and we go into his neuroses, and we use stylistic animated sequences and a musical sequence in the movie that sort of harks back to the John Hughes musical numbers that he had in his movies.
You do the whole song. You know, I was thinking, we're just going to get a little bit, and then you do actually the 3.5 minutes of Under Pressure.
Yeah, there's an edit in there, so we cut out about a minute and a half of the song, but yeah, it's pretty much the whole song, and that's fun. We just really wanted to have fun and with that sequence, and but at the same time, that said, there are also moments of subtle, nuanced, grounded acting, and that's really my favorite part of filmmaking is getting two actors in a room and just really letting them do their thing.
The interesting thing with your film is, whilst I enjoyed it enormously and it was funny, I did think, well, I'm laughing here at something which I think is probably increasingly real to teenagers here in the UK and in America too, is mental illness. Or at least the diagnosis of it by the elderly system, who kind of say, well, you've got this, and the drug-addled youth that we have, the prescription drug-addled youth that we have. It is a serious topic, mental illness, and yet your film kind of handles it lightly. Given that when you had Baseball and Sugar, you handled that with a seriousness, with great empathy for the poor baseball player, and indeed for our drug addicted, system confined teacher and children in Half Nelson. Was that a decision that how do we make a comedy out of something that is potentially kind of, you know, socially quite an important topic?
Well, having the book as a guide was a big deal because Ned really balanced that really well in his book, and it leans comedic. There's a lot of humor in it, but there again, there are really wonderfully dramatic, serious themes, as you said, and he handled that delicate balance so well that with that as our guide, we really couldn't go wrong as long as we didn't stray too far from. Yeah.
You wanted to keep that the comedic.
Yeah, I think again that's something new for us is the more comedic style of storytelling, and that was a challenge for us because neither Anna and I are very funny. So
you're very
we relied on our actors for that.
Although there was always Half Nelson, there was funny in there too.
Yes, very funny movie. Everyone knows that. This is one of the great
interrupting cow joke in.
That's right. There are some poorly timed jokes in that film as well.
I have to say, I was reminded of Half Nelson, obviously, when I saw Blue Valentine here at the London Film Festival as well, which starred Ryan Gosling. And I was watching it, and then I was thinking, there's some jokes in that movie too. And they were kind of Half Nelson jokes. You know, there was a knock-knock joke, I think they tell each other and stuff. And then I'm thinking, it kind of looks a bit like Half Nelson as well. And then I'm thinking, I wonder if it's that same cinematographer that I've spoken to Ryan Fleck about. Is it Andre Perek? And I'm thinking in my head. And then there's a shot of the Brooklyn Bridge, and I'm thinking, he's good at the Brooklyn Bridge, is Andre Perek. And then at the end, it came up shot by him. Yeah. So it was your cinematographer.
That's right. We had a lot of the same crew, same producers, same assistant director, same cinematographer.
And Ryan.
And that's a phenomenal movie. Yes, definitely. Love that movie. Yeah.
But so was Half Nelson a direct influence on Derek Cianfrance's film there? I mean,
I think it's because of... Andre, if there's any influence, it's Andre, and that's the connection. Yeah.
Because you used him here again, and it's kind of a funny story, right?
Yeah, he's just a wonderful artist and cinematographer.
Right. And how do you work with him? What's your... Because you've obviously used him... did you use him in Sugar too? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the third time now. So you have this relationship that you're kind of building up. You work with Anna Boden and the cinematographer to create the kind of tone of your world, I guess.
Yeah, it's nice to work with the same people because you start to understand each other and trust each other in a way that you can't necessarily do in the first movie. You're still discovering a language and a way of working smoothly, but the meetings become less frequent and you just have a few in the beginning and you talk about the tone and the look and then boom, you let them do their magic.
I remember speaking to you and Anna for the first time about Half Nelson and like how you would continue to work together. And how you would continue that relationship, whereas one going to want to kind of go do a George Michael and go solo. But you're not, you're still doing it.
Yeah, Wham is still very much alive in the Fleck-Bowden duo. Yeah, no, it's been a great run for us with the three films, and we've each one has had its challenges, but they've been really wonderful experiences, so we hopefully will continue to do that.
Ryan Fleck, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And it's A Kind of Funny Story is on limited release here in the UK. Well, that's all the madness and marital strife we have time for this week. The music featured in this week's show is the soundtrack to It's A Kind of Funny Story, and it's well worth checking out. Do join us on our Facebook page, Film Weekly Fans. Join the group this week, and you're in with a chance to win tickets to see the new David Byrne concert film, Ride, Rise, Roar. Up for grabs is a chance to attend a VIP drinks reception before the screening, a pair of tickets to the premiere screening, and a Q&A with Byrne at the Ritzy Brixton on Thursday, January the 20th. Now, I know that's London-centric, but it may be worth a trip if you win. Now, to enter, you do need to be a Film Weekly fan. So join us on Facebook by Monday, the 17th of January, and then you're in with a chance. This week's episode is dedicated to the most recent addition to the Film Weekly fan club, Sevi Leo Solomons. But for now, from me, Zan Brooks, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.